Hi, this is Ryan Monkman from Field Bird Cidery in Prince Edward County, Ontario, the north side of Lake Ontario, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 132. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week, we are in Ontario in Prince Edward County on the north shore of Lake Ontario, speaking with Ryan Monkman of Field Bird Cider and Lee Baker, the winemaker at Kenty Winery and Vineyards, all based in Wellington, Ontario. There's going to be more on that chat and a lot more on barrel aging cider and what you could do to understand that product and also increase your skills. So stay tuned for that. In the meanwhile, let's get a little updates out and about in Ciderville. A big tip of the glass to Colleen, who is now a patron of Cider Chat via the Cider Chat Patreon page. It looks like you are from London. You are a Yank in London. I see the Twitter. There's a Twitter connection here, so I'm going to be following you. Boom, I just followed you. And if you want to follow Colleen too, because it looks like she is a fun person. It's a lovely photo of her with her arms straight out, her knees bent, and she's jumping up really high with water in the background. Some beautiful place around the world. Says that she's a Yank in London who loves trees, beer, cider, travel, cycling, and sarcasm. Well, I got a bit of that. Views are her own. Again, she's based in London, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes if you want to follow her too. And you could follow along on another fun-loving person out there in Ciderville. And also become a patron like Colleen. It's pretty easy. Just Google Cider Chat Patreon. That's one way. Or go to links at ciderchat.com. Now, I've been seeing a lot of nutritional statistics on cider bottles more recently, primarily in the U.S., telling you the calorie count and what's involved and all that jazz. And I'm not sure about the regulations on it, whether it's required or not. I'm thinking it's going to maybe be more required, or it's just a nice thing that people do. One person that immediately comes to mind is John Edwards at N, that's N as in like Nancy, M-R, Services, that's based in Connecticut, and he does analysis, and he did the workshop called Chemical Fingerprints, which I am still hoping to get up there because I'm trying to sync up his audio with the video, and that takes a little bit of time, and that technicality around the video is not my specialty. I'm more audio related, so I'm trying to figure out how to best deliver that to you. But if you are thinking of, you know, as a commercial maker or somebody who is doing research in this area, you might want to contact John. So he is a part of the Cider Going Up campaign, one of the commercial entities that helps this podcast stay on the air. So you could look, always scroll on all the show notes. I always list all the folks who are the commercial makers or, again, cider trade people such as John Edwards at MNR Services in Connecticut, and you can find out their contact info there, because this is probably going to be growing, and I think that right now he's helping out, you know, different cideries. And so if that's something of interest to you, do follow that link. You could always find it at ciderchat.com. Just go to any of the show notes and you're going to see that person. You're going to see that listing for John Edwards there, and you're going to see all the other great cideries and makers who support this here podcast. This past weekend, I was judging at the Big E, and that the full name of this fair is called the Eastern States Exposition. It's been taking place in Agawam, Massachusetts, since 1916, and it just so happens to be the largest agricultural fair in the region, and I mean the New England region. And they have this annual fair that takes place the second Labor Day of every year since 1916. When I was a kid, I remember my folks taking me out of school to go to the Big E, and I just had the most fondest memories of that. It certainly left me with a lasting impression about agriculture and the value for agriculture and supporting it in your local markets. Probably it's a good reason why I am doing this podcast today, because if not for the revival of the apple scene and the orchardists, a lot of farmers would be hurting, certainly in New England. Not that they are out of the water yet, but it definitely helps them. And, you know, gotta love those farmers and all the extra value-added jobs that come on there throughout the whole economy. So yes, the Big E is really something, and they had this competition, which I was able to judge at. In fact, I recorded the judging of the Best in Show, and that's going to be going up on a Cider Chat Live episode. So keep your eye out for that. I'll be posting it when it is live. It won't be that long. It's just a segment on the actual judging of the Best in Show. Now, I didn't want to jump the gun because as of this moment, while I'm doing this recording right now, the winners do not know that they have been awarded anything. So I'm going to hold off on some of it. But I did talk to the organizers and they said I could announce the Best in Show for cider. And that goes to none other than West County Cider, based in Coleraine, Massachusetts. And it is for their Redfield Cider, which has this lovely blush, kind of, I would say like a plum blush, a very light plum blush cider. It was delicious. It has a blend, of course, of primarily of Redfield apple, which the Maloneys, who are the West County people surrounding that particular cidery, really brought in that apple, and now it's being used all over the map. So kudos to Field Maloney, who has taken on the cider making at that cidery. If you've been following along, if you've ever been to Cider Days, you would know West County Cider. It is the first commercial cidery in the United States post-Prohibition. And it's nice to, you know, they've had some rough years when Terry Maloney was passed away. So it's nice to see Field get this medal at this time. But I do want to say, I tried a lot of those ciders. I thought they were all really good, you know, coming in from all over the map, a wide variation. And a lot of ciders being made with culinary apples, that super surprised me. Some made with full-on Honeycrisp apples. That was like, what? But it worked. Stay tuned for that Cider Chat Live. I'll be posting it on Facebook and on social media, Cider Chat at Ciderville on Instagram, once I get that uploaded and fine-tuned for you. When we come back, we're going to be heading to our main chat with both Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider and Lee Baker, the winemaker at Kenty Winery and Vineyard in Wellington, Ontario. It's going to be on barrels. We're down in the barrel cellar having fun. So be right back with that. In the meanwhile, go get your glass filled and ready to enjoy some fun conversation and a lot of info on barrels and making cider. With me out of downtown Wellington, Ontario. We're going to drive along the lake about a mile or so out of town heading west. We're going to bang a right at the sign that says Kenty Winery and Vineyard and drive a short amount up a hill on a dirt road. To our left are vines of grapes cascading down the hill. And as we're rising the crest, we could see a large building with a nice veranda in the front and Adirondack chairs facing the lake. This is where Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider and I made our stop to talk about his ciders and speak with his friend Lee Baker, who is a winemaker at Kenty Winery. You and I are going to go in through the tasting room and follow Ryan down into the belly of the winery, which is below ground.
The wine thief must be downstairs. So It's produced under Kente's
the
license.
The wine thief. Let's go see the wine thief. I love that term. It's that you steal wine and cider out of a barrel. It's a particular
So it means I use their license. Mm-hmm. So all of the cider that we make, Kente reports it under their licensing and under their taxation and stuff like that. So it's honestly a big, big burden on them. And they've been very generous with their time and with their energy and helping us get going while we wait to build our own spot. So
nice. That's really fantastic.
Cool. And I think right here, Lee, who I get to spend all sorts of time with.
We're going to be walking down some metal staircases and see the large fermentation room ahead. This is where the magic happens for Lee and Ryan. Lee has the music cranking as we enter, and the two friends meet and greet, and I get introduced. And then in short order, we are talking barrel aging cider and all the components that come into managing a barrel. And you and I are going to delve deep into that and find out a bit about batonnage. But first, let's go in and talk about the barrel room setup with both Lee Baker of Kenty Winery and Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider. In this room here shares space with the cider that Ryan...
Yeah, so Ryan we both came here at the same time, practically. Huh? I was here maybe a month before he was.
Wow.
Which he never lets me forget.
Yeah. So I'm the elder here.
But in truth, these guys are helping each other out throughout the season, getting the fermentation right and being able to throw ideas back and forth to each other.
A lot of these cellar jobs need two people. You need somebody to help you out. And,
or it takes you just sometimes three times the amount of time to do it yourself.
Forever, exactly.
Right. Yeah,
because you're rigging stuff up to hold a hose down, running back and forth and pulling plugs out.
Let me give you a little image of what the room was like that we were standing in that holds all the barrels. It was made out of repurposed highway underpasses, so it was concrete sections with a curved ceiling, making it a perfect kind of a kind of fun cave sensation under there. It's super well lit, and all the barrels you'll note are going to be on these like almost like a 4x4s, they're not quite 6x6s, long beams along the ground. And Lee and I will be talking a little bit on how that sets up and what it provides for the oak barrels. But one more thing before we go on. Something to know about this region that produces so much amazing wine is that in the winter, they bury the vines. Each spring, they bring the vines up above ground again, but they have to cover them for the cold. So let's get back to this chat. We'll be talking about more about the cellar room and how it's set up and how the barrels are held into place. We have the barrels just sitting on these long beams here with gravel underneath the barrel so you could get some of the moisture,
exposed,
the humidity.
It's actually exposed soil.
Exposed soil.
Yeah, so moisture can actually come and go as it pleases.
Mm-hmm.
And actually last year where we had a crazy amount of water coming down, there's actually water just pouring down these cracks.
Wow.
And then just going into the rocks and then it just all just leaches away slowly but surely.
And that's nice. I mean, because humidity is such a key factor
for the barrels that we were learning the other day in our chit-chat with the barrel makers, Radu and Thierry Lamar.
So one of the things that we like to say is that terroir doesn't only stop, or it doesn't stop in the vineyard. It actually carries through down here because of the lack of temperature control and humidity control. It kind of comes and goes as it pleases. We can influence it very slightly in here to stop things from freezing. Mm-hmm. But that's about the only capability that we have. So in a year like 2016, where it was really hot and dry, it was really dry down here. And it was very hot down here. So I don't inoculate for malolactic fermentation. They raced off and they were done way well before Christmas. So I had to make the choice whether or not to put it underneath sulfur. And sometimes I'm a nervous winemaker, so I put sulfur in them. And so the difference is in 2017, where it was a very cold and drawn out season, we picked later and it got cold very fast. So right now, I have no sulfur in any of these barrels right now because mallow is just kicking off again. So it's actually, they're just reawakening. Actually today I walked down, I was down here yesterday and did a bit of a bung check, and then I came down and there was two bungs that had popped off because of a mallow.
One of my barrels kicked off last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the sulfur chemistry in wine and cider making is very important as far as, say, fixing color in Pinot Noir. So there was a study just recently done where they did post-mallow sulfur add versus non-sulfur add. And it I forget exactly the duration of it, but what they were doing is that they were just trying to see if you can fix color better in the absence of SO2, mm-hmm. and to see if the safety of the wine, as far as VA content goes, was affected at all. So they topped everything weekly for duration, and then they did analysis on the color and on the VA, and the color was significantly changed. There was way more color fixed in the Pinot Noirs without sulfur, post-mallow. I think it was Pinot. It might have been a different red. And then the VAs were no significant changes. Just because if you're maintaining proper ullage space, as in following a good regime of weekly topping.
Ullage,
so the airspace.
Airspace, okay.
So topping up that angel share. The angels come down at nighttime.
Mm-hmm. They drink all the wine, right? Yeah.
But how it works?
Yeah. So then that is the reason why VA is created, because the bacteria that creates it needs oxygen. But if you deprive it of oxygen, VA is not going to come in.
And let's just say what VA is.
Volatile acidity. So vinegar, essentially.
Right. And then there was another term that you're... malolactic fermentation. Can we just give a short, you know, the synopsis of malolactic fermentation? Because you see it all over, today. And for folks listening who have no idea.
Yeah. So there's different kinds of acid out there. So if you think of, like, lemon juice is high in citric acid. Grapes have more something called tartaric acid than malic acid, but they have some malic acid. And there's bacteria strains that can basically eat malic acid and poop out something called lactic acid. It's not quite like that.
They more cleave
it off. but there's bacteria that turn malic acid into carbon dioxide and lactic acid. Lactic acid is like the creamy, yogurty acid. Malic acid is the acid in apples.
Yeah, so like if you bite into a green apple,
yeah,
that's malic acid. That sensation in your mouth is very harsh, right? But then all the acids that as you put in yogurt, so lactic, you know, comes from the dairy because it's found in dairy. Mm-hmm. It's nice and kind of mouth-filling and buttery and so on and so forth. So when you start getting butter and caramel and butterscotch and all those fun things and, like, say, Chardonnay, right, it's not coming from the oak aging, which a lot of people think it is. It's actually a byproduct of the malolactic fermentation.
Yeah. So on the wine front, almost every red wine and some white wines go through malolactic fermentation.
So one of the things that it actually takes away from, like, the fruity, like the very, very primary fruits, sort of talking apple, lemon, all the tree fruits or stone fruits and so on and so forth in Chardonnay, it's actually going to kind of decrease those a little bit. They still will be there in most cases, and maybe not all cases, after the malolactic fermentation, but it's going to bring on these secondary kind of characteristics that I was just describing with the butterscotch flavors.
Mm-hmm. But with apples, because almost all the acid in apples is malic, it can get a little... It can get a little too creamy. Why don't we try?
Let's try it. Okay.
So I got...
Now we're walking down into the back of the barrel room.
The one that kicked off, the bubbles that knocked out. Malolactic bacteria, we talked about malolactic fermentation, kicks off carbon dioxide. So one of the ways you can tell if it's active is to listen to the barrel. So this just kicked off again. So if you put your ear up to the bunghole...
And what do we hear?
You'll hear carbon dioxide bubbles being cleaved off the malic acid and being released into the air. So it sounds almost like Rice Krispies. We talk about like using all your senses in the cellar. So listening is a really important one. The obvious one being that when you hear water spill on the floor, run to wherever the sound's coming from and fix the broken valve. You can track fermentation in addition to smelling and tasting and monitoring. You can track fermentation by sound. So primary fermentation is going to start like a little rumble and it will get to that Rice Krispie stage. But then like vigorous fermentation, when you listen to it, is going to sound like popcorn. Pop, 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 pop. And just like when you used to have to like...
How does that go again?
Pop, 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 pop. And just like when you used to have to listen, remember in the bag, we don't make microwave popcorn anymore. But
even bag, if you put it in your pot, it's just a little bit more metallic.
Yeah, yeah. On the bag, it's like, you know, stop the thing when it's like 2 or 3 seconds between pops. That's a good sign for fermentation too. So when that popping slows down and it goes down to just pop, 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 you know your yeast is almost done. So if your yeast is almost done and you're almost out of sugar, that's great. But if you hear that sound change, but your sugar is still present, you're still tasting sugar, then you know your yeast are really stressed and you need to do everything you can to get them healthy again so they finish the ferment. So it's a way to like kind of track it.
Or you'd be like me and just be like, I'll just wait till it gets warmer in the
I'll
cellar.
Just wait.
I still have shards, about 7 barrels of shards still fermenting 8 months later.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to do it. I mean, you know, what you're talking about here is really that craft of like the sound and all the little nuances that happen here.
Up next, we're going to be doing a comparative tasting between two different barrels of cider. And Ryan will lead us through that. And I think you'll be able to virtually follow along. We're going to be talking about malolactic fermentation and digging a little bit deeper into the process of what's happening in the barrel with the cider and how you can manage it and bring it to its full potential glory.
This is a barrel of cider. It's finished primary a couple months ago. It's still sitting on primary lees, so that sediment from that the yeast made, it's still sitting with it. I stir it pretty regularly. This did not go through malolactic fermentation.
Did not.
Did not.
So how do you stop it from happening, Ryan?
We work in a cellar that's 4 degrees in the winter, that helps. Malolactic fermentation won't happen when it's cold. And then also through the addition of sulfur. So sulfur, in addition to protecting the cider if there is too much headspace, also prevents malolactic fermentation.
Can you feed nutrients into the barrel also from malolactic?
For malolactic? Yeah.
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 Sometimes when you do inoculated bacterial malolactic fermentation, you can actually buy it with a kit that actually has a rehydration and nutrient add that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes not. It doesn't take very much nutrients to get it to go through. Mainly what it doesn't like...
There's also an open one over there.
It doesn't like... Extremely low pHs, but you can buy cultures that are better at really high acidity kind of environments. It doesn't like extreme cold. So as we're saying, when it got to about 7 degrees in here, nothing's happened, right? And it doesn't like high alcohols, which is another one, but it really doesn't like sulfur. So you add sulfur and you have free sulfur in solution, it's just not going to go. It doesn't like it. So sometimes, depending on the yeast that you're using, or if you're using spontaneous yeast and you don't really know what yeast is in there, they can create varying levels of SO2 during the primary fermentation. So if you have a yeast culture that produces a fair amount of SO2, it can actually delay or prevent MLF from happening. So sometimes when you are choosing your yeast and you want malolactic to go through, that's one thing to take in consideration.
So this is the same juice blend, 72% golden russet, wine sap, and spot. Almost the same primary fermentation, but this one went full malolactic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's got a way different aroma.
Crazy
way,
different aroma.
Way. Not as fruity. It's not as clean. It's got some good, like, kind of earthy tones to it and everything.
Yeah.
So depending on the style, it changes the style so dramatically.
Immensely. Yeah. I mean, when we first pulled it out, I was like, whoa, I was probably about 7 inches from my nose. I was just like letting it kind of.
So the other thing that Mallow can do, especially to a winemaker as nervous as I am, is it can throw you through a loop mentally, because it will make some funky aromas as it's going through. So if you're at that kind of midpoint or like just kicking off point, it will smell really, really differently almost on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And then you can get really nervous about where things are going.
Yeah.
Comes up.
So now are you blending?
I will, but we'll hold this one up and blend.
So not yet.
Not yet. Well, you can try this one, but this is just started malolactic, like 2 days or I don't know.
Look at how foggy it is.
Super foggy. It's kicking off good.
Yeah.
So same blend.
Same blend. This one just is starting.
Same orchard and everything. All came in at the same time. Same press. Everything.
Yep. So
different yeast treatment.
Yeah. Different yeast treatments.
Okay.
So primary, I do everything that I touch gets a different primary. Process.
As you get to know Ryan a bit more, you realize that he doesn't do anything the easy way. And most of the time, there's a good reason why he isn't. And one of the things that I noticed is that he was bringing down his juice before he inoculated. And then he would do, you must have had 20 different yeasts on the go at one point. Because he had this palette over here that has all of like the different pieces of tape and everything and have all the different lettering on it. He was doing yeast trials, so he might, like, in the realm of 20 yeasts,
right? The most I had going at one time during harvest this year was 46 separate primaries.
Right.
Which,
for a small batch,
was too much. But I like that. I like the building complexity. So everything I want to touch, I want to do a little bit differently. Now, there's some things they all get in common. I tend to favor high amino nutrients because I'm trying to push ester development, because I really think esters are pretty in cider. So those floral notes, the almost banana notes, I like those a lot. I also am pretty heavy into lees treatment. So not this lees, but sediment lees.
Awesome.
So I use a lot of lees stirring, a lot of lees treatment. I tend to pass lees from one thing to another. So these barrels here, in addition to their own primary lees, are also sitting with Northern Spy fermentation lees.
And lees lees.
That I added in. And lees lees. So one of the barrels was fermented with a spontaneous ferment that Lee did on Pinot Gris. I kept those lees and used them. So like by the time I have stuff in the barrel towards the end of barrel aging,
you have no idea what's going on.
It can be like, No. There are some loosely written notes. I sometimes have a lot of losses racking out of barrel, because you'd expect like a 5% loss coming out of barrel.
Let's talk about the lees.
Yes.
And what you're doing there, because I know folks out in Ciderville listening to this right now are like, okay, what the heck are they talking about in terms of incorporating the lees? Because, you know, as we know it, just to kind of bring it down to a basic level,
you know, you typically have it in your glass carboy, right, at that 5 gallon, and you rack off the lees to clarify it. But when you're working with a barrel, you have these, or even in the carboy, you have these other options,
right,
like Sir Lee. And,
So what I'll say here is the vessel with lees contact, the vessel doesn't matter. It does matter because if you have a long, short one, you'll get more contact. But what I mean is...
It's like the barrel on its side, right?
Yeah.
You think of the it's being spread out of the bottom of the barrel, so mm-hmm. you get a higher surface area to volume ratio, yeah. so you mm-hmm. get more effect.
But mm-hmm. if you're using a carboy, you can still use lees contact. There's nothing that the oak is giving it, is what I'll say.
Right.
So what's great about lees contact is...
Except for maybe oxygen, but that's...
Yeah.
It's going to sink out of here.
Okay. The lees give a huge amount of things. One, you're keeping an active life force involved longer. Mm-hmm. And we know that whenever there is life, there is joy and there is magic and something's happening when something's happening.
Can you tell that he's just bought a biodynamic farm?
Yes. And I know quite a bit about biodynamicness, so yeah, way into it.
There are a couple of technical things that are really great. One, healthy lees will absorb
a gross number of things.
So
much stuff.
So
think of like if you're not doing a biodynamic farm or organic farm, but you're conventional farming, which, you know, the vast majority of farms are, you're spraying all these things. And what's the main thing that you're spraying? Well, you're spraying things that are trying to kill fungus. And what is yeast that's doing your mm-hmm. fermentation for you? Well, that's a fungus, right? So mm-hmm. it may be targeted as well. So what's the great thing about adding, you know, you can buy kind of yeast hulls, so they're deactivated yeast, essentially it's lees that has been deactivated. Mm-hmm. They'll actually absorb all of that and clean it up for you and let it go. Or say heavy metals are in the sprays, or you're using heavy metals in fining if something goes wrong and so on and so forth, and it's getting in the way. You can use those lees to do it, and they will grab onto everything. They're good little absorbers, mm-hmm. but then at the same time, they're also breaking down and offering so much more. And that's the really fun stuff.
Yeah. So when
are you stirring the lees in?
And so it's called batonnage. I literally just did it to all these barrels just before you came in. That's why there's no bungs on all of them.
You don't have your barrels on any kind of roller. So are you just rolling the barrels back and forth? Are you putting something in there to stir?
No, it's actually just like a long stainless steel stick that has a little blade at the end. If you're using variable top lids and a crazy Italian guy, you might be using a paddle.
The canoe paddles don't fit into barrels.
But people with barrels do have them on rollers, and there's some, you know, the ones that do put them on rollers and spin it around. Right?
Here's the downside of rollers. It's not you doing it. When you spin the barrel, but you're not in the barrel. When you use a baton, like a stainless steel rod, you have to open the barrel, you smell it, you put it in, and you're physically moving the wine. You're not moving the barrel, which is moving the wine. You are moving the wine, and you form that connection with it. Mm-hmm. And you get to see the lees kick up into suspension.
So you
get the smell
scraping action to really lift it up and mm-hmm. do a big full turn.
Yeah.
I think the rollers are like originally were for just like ease of cleaning. Mm-hmm. You know, so after you're done, you can roll them on these rollers, take the bung out, and throw your cleaning gamma jet underneath there and blast everything out. The other thing that they're used for a fair amount now, which is a new going trend in red wine making, is red wine barrel ferment. So they're actually, instead of doing a punch down or a pump over, which is kind of hard to do in a barrique barrel, they're actually just rolling them so to get the cap mixed in there and everything all wet and juiced up and everything. As far as stirring, like, I think the main thing is batonnage, so using that baton and stir.
And you're talking about putting a little baton in a very small hole. I mean, that's, you know, 2 inches across.
Right.
So you put that in, and then you are stirring in. Yeah, hell yeah, let's do it.
Just sitting in the-
Just to kind of take it out of that technical kind of beginner's mind again, that's something that people don't realize is when you make cider, you really need to have enough extra cider, whether it's a carboy or a barrel to top it off.
Sure. And if you run out, go buy some cider. You know?
Right, exactly. Something, get it in there.
Yeah. Don't start topping it with water.
Right.
What they used to use, if you're going for the traditional route, is pond water.
Oh!
Yeah.
Really?
So always, yeah, in the
why?
1700s, 1600s.
Because that's all they had.
Because it was important to keep the barrel full.
And that's why you put anything in there.
So I would not recommend pond water.
No, I would not.
Other ciders, it's good. And it's not like, it's you know what it is?
This cider has rich in sediment and taffles.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're just lending it to the barrel. You're going to get it back. Mm-hmm. You're going to get it back when you empty the barrel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it'll be better.
So, Ryan, you
a little bit of a
little stirring here before you get there, buddy. Let me just get this set.
I've also heard quasi-science things of, like when you put the yeast back in suspension, they're taking space away from other microbes that might be there. It adds like a false competition. And again, it's like quasi-science, like it's not really, but maybe it has something.
Maybe.
You're also disturbing the surface where there would be a load of dissolved oxygen at the very top, even if you have 500 mils of air in there, right? And then it's all of a sudden you're stirring it up, so then you don't have that layer of dissolved oxygen. It's kind of all in there, and then some of the yeast might be grabbing onto some of that, and then you're topping it up and getting rid of all the rest of the oxygen, letting go of some whatever CO2 might be in there as well, and purging off that DO. So it helps you. And if you become regimented and you get into a routine, and I always find that with winemaking, it's good to get into a routine, same with cleaning your house, right? So like every week, if it's every Friday or every Thursday, you know you have scheduled that half day to go down and stir and top your barrels. And then while you're there, let's taste some, you know, because the bung's open, this is a perfect opportunity. And what better thing to indicate an early sign of something that might be going wrong than you actually sticking your nose in the bung and taking a sample of it?
Cool. So barrel stirring, and maybe a little more practical.
Next up here, what you're going to be hearing is Ryan is doing a demonstration that he referred to as barrel stirring and also as batonnage. He is standing over a large 55-gallon barrel that's on the ground, and he's putting in a baton. It's made out of stainless steel. It's a rod that could go all the way down to the base of the barrel, so it's pretty long. And at the foot of this rod is a very thin rectangular pedal, if you will. And you're going to hear the knocking back and forth in the barrel. So he first puts it down into the barrel, and he is scooping it up as he's going. It's hitting one end of the barrel's head and to the other end, scooping it around. And then he actually will lift up so that pedal, that foot, that creates a friction to move the cider up in the air, and it moves all the lees into suspension, which is exactly what we're talking about. You want to have full contact with the cider onto the lees. Otherwise, the lees will just go and sit down at the base of whatever vessel you have it on, whether it's in a carboy or in a barrel. So the key here is to keep the lees in suspension, and you do that by using batonnage. We're going to listen to him. He'll explain a bit, but there is also a video of this very demo that will be on the show notes for this here episode 132. And it's also at the Cider Chat YouTube channel. Okay, back to Ryan doing the technique known as batonnage.
So multiple strokes back and forth.
You can actually, when you're looking at it, you can actually see this clear patch, and then all of it just gets really cloudy. There's videos on YouTube with people that have plexiglass heads on the barrel, so you can actually see it roll
around
inside.
Yeah,
it's really,
that's
really
fun.
So the really important things is you want to be smelling it before and after, ideally even tasting in a glass, and then after you stir, you top.
You top it off with extra liquid.
Yep.
So you went pretty briskly with that. Is that your technique, or you're just kind of doing it quick for because...
Well, my goal is to get what's on the bottom into the side.
Up into it. So you have to be kind of
you
gotta
give it a good.
Yeah, give it a good.
Cool. Okay. So it's not a slow canoe paddle. It's we're not, boom.
We're not being...
You're not doing the J-stroke here.
Okay.
We're not being, we're not being gentle. You're not being actively aggressive, but you gotta, you're trying to kick up the stuff in the suspension. Right?
Yeah, speak so through these. Cool. Yeah, let me try it. Thank you. How exciting.
Well, when I didn't do the video, I should have done this with smell the barrel, but...
With what? Smell the barrels. Okay. So were you putting...
I was just switching it because that bung's got
this
a stain
on
it.
This one here or this one here?
Use this one. Do this one.
Do this one.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take this off.
So that's a great barrel.
We're going to take that off. Smell it. Oh, it smells like the world's best cider. We're going to put this in this little bucket.
Normally we'd have a bucket with some...
Okay,
so
we're going to put it in like this. Have a good in like that. And at first I'm going to go like this, right? Kind of just...
So really scrape along the bottom. Shove it all the way down,
And that sounds good. There's a certain sound just like the popping, right? I could see it kind of coming up. Getting both sides and I'm turning it. How's that? I can see it looks a lot more slurry and it really cloudy. I do this all day.
That's all the good stuff.
Yeah.
You're hired.
Awesome. Thank you. Batonnage.
It's like one of the best things ever to say, right? Batonnage.
It's a pretty super cool name, too.
Here, I need to take that away.
No! We gotta do another one.
Oh, really? What happened?
I wasn't recording.
It's one of those moments in time. I got you.
Oh, no way.
I got you, baby.
He's got the little bone top there. Yeah.
Another one too.
That was fun.
Exactly.
So that's where it gets harder, where you kind of have to climb up and do it up there.
Do
you
know, like it's so managed.
You just stand on another barrel and do it. Yeah.
So I never even talked about the cider. That's gonna be with glasses. So the reason to do different treatments or just to try and build complexity during primary and during aging and keep things separate so that later on you have more to play with when you're blending.
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of the blending process of choosing which barrels go together is to figure out who make the best dance partners. So who works the best in the glass together. So this is, three random barrels, but I can't even know which one mine is, but if you want to give that a go, which is in your glass, there's the blend of the three barrels. And the idea is that together they're more complex than any of them were by themselves. Mm-hmm. So you spend all your time in the cellar, you're just trying to build the puzzle pieces which you're going to use to build the puzzle later.
It's great. It's really great. So you are working with Winesap, Northern Spy, and...
So this one we're tasting right now is 72%. Okay, 72% golden russet. It's about 16% Northern Spy, 12% Winesap.
Okay, yeah, really lovely, complexity in that cider, it's really kind of coming along.
Yeah.
And this is from 2017. And your plan with this is to have it in the bottle by?
I don't really know. At some point, it's going to be tasting where it needs to be tasting, and then we'll look to bottle it. So it's not there yet. I think it needs more time in barrel. It still needs to develop. It needs to blend together. Just within each barrel, they need to become more cooperative with each other. There's some decent tannin in there, so that works really well.
Definitely.
With overaging.
Yeah.
So... We'll see.
And doesn't the lees add a bit of the tannin structure to it? Could provide that a bit?
If
you took it out, you would kind of lose a big chunk of that mouthfeel.
Especially we talked about autolysis. So autolysis kind of works slowly. About 9 months after fermentation, autolysis really ramps up.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of, you finish fermentation in December or January, it's not really until you hit July, August that you're starting to get those really good yeast flavors. So you got to keep it going, keep it going, keep it going. And then in August and September, just when you're hitting into next harvest, you're like rewarded so richly by this the creamy fullness coming through. So kind of like when you're in harvest and you're tired and you're wet and you're cold and you're hungry and you're tasting the stuff from the previous season still in barrel, that's when you're kind of like, oh my God, I can actually kind of do this, which is really wonderful.
I want to ask just kind of a couple like barrel mistakes that people did.
Sure.
So it's gone down, we know about that, it could get acetic and vinegary. What about like, what you know, you see that kind of like cloudy filminess
on the top?
Yeah.
So that has to do with oxygen as well.
Yeah.
And what is that?
It's yeast.
It's like floor yeast.
Floor yeast. So it's yeast responding with oxygen. So you get that, really, you can get that in almost anything, but it's most common when something has a high pH. And has too much headspace. So if there's a lot of air in the barrel, that's when you start to get it.
That will happen. And so
it creates a vast array of different chemical compounds, but the main fault that you'll find in it after is ethyl acetate.
Yeah.
So ethyl acetate smells like nail polish from the barrel. And it's incredibly difficult to remove.
Is there a way to remove
it? You have to bring in a reverse osmosis. And it is possible, but it is very, very, this is where we start getting into manipulation of wine.
Yeah.
And most of the time it's to correct mistakes such as this.
Yes. And if you get there, it is possible using some fairly expensive technology on large scale to remove it, but you will not have a good product after that process.
That's not fair.
There's technology, sometimes. Yes, there's technology being developed right now, which can do it very, very well. There's some firms in Italy working on technology to do it really, really well. But the people currently providing the service don't have the new technology.
And does it ruin the barrel?
No. Essentially, able to sanitize it afterwards.
Okay.
We call it
film yeast,
pond scum.
You think about sherry is made in this way.
And it looks, you know, kind of cool, like a cloud. I've seen, you know, the photos and stuff. But people are, you know, I'm seeing online recommendation for people to go below it and siphon.
Bottom rack.
Yeah, can you
Or
do
you
that?
Can overflow.
We generally overflow.
It could happen in the winery and you could still, like, save the...
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's mainly at the top. It's concentrated at the top where the yeast are active.
It's only active at the top.
Right.
Yeah. So what you do is you don't stir it right away, and you very slowly top it,
and you top it
with an extra couple of liter, maybe an extra liter, very slowly, and that surface yeast floats, and floats out of the barrel.
That's interesting to know. So it's not a total gone cause if that happens to somebody. You could overflow it. Suction some of it off? I mean, if you're going to overflow it,
good luck trying to skim it off. Skimming is so small, it breaks apart too easy. You're not going to be able to skim
but
it.
But overflowing
is really easy to do.
Is it?
Yeah. And then the other thing is that if you have access to a filtration system, like if you're small scale, a mini jet and so on and so forth, get it down to sterile as fast as you can. And then that will take away from the population and help prevent it from happening again. Make sure your sulfur levels are back up to normal because they aren't going to form if there's high SO2, free SO2s. And then just make sure you're putting it in a proper size container and keeping it cool because they will definitely speed up. If you have it like in your house, it's not air conditioned. You have it on like the top floor of your house. Well,
not a good setting.
Maybe you want to pick a different place to put your barrel or your carboys.
Now, because I think it happens more often than not that people get this. You know, that little yeast film. Up there.
It's quite common. Like even in professional wineries, it does happen.
And Pinot Noir gets it very often.
I saw more in British Columbia because we're dealing with higher pHs.
Yeah.
So when you say manage the sulfur, so like with a hobbyist, would they be putting in like Camden tablets or?
Yeah, no,
you don't really want to do that in a barrel, would you?
So That's right, okay. One thing that I think that home winemaking lacks the most of
is sulfur
and acid management.
Okay.
So as a winemaker, the two main tools that I have during the élevage of the wine, so the duration after fermentation, the aging of wine, is I watch pH and levels of SO2. So after malolactic fermentation, your pH is going to be a lot different. So then you check your pH then. So a good pH meter is essential.
Any pH meter is better than no pH meter.
No pH meter, yeah.
Even if you're doing a litmus test, it's giving you a ballpark.
Yeah, even if you're using
right, the paper. The
exactly.
Paper.
Exactly. Do something. Just crazy. Do something.
It's more important. It's the pH meter is less important than knowing how to calibrate it well. So a pH meter is going to come with a little booklet that can tell you how to calibrate it.
What to do.
And calibrate it every time you use it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing that, then even if...
The instrument you're talking about, calibrate it, not the actual size of the
double
hand.
Yeah, if you're able to properly calibrate the instrument, you're going to be close, even with the bad probe, and close is better than guessing.
Thank you to both Ryan and Lee. Lee Baker of Kenty Winery and Vineyard in Wellington, Ontario, and of course Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider, also in Wellington, Ontario. These two guys have an amazing rapport, and I've gotten so much info. I mean, we learned about how to do batonnage, and I love the quote from Lee, "Terroir doesn't end in the field," and how they bring that in into the cellar room, having the barrels up on those long beams so you could roll it back and forth, and if there's spillage, it's just going back into the earth there. And then the quote from Ryan Monkman talking about working in the cellar, where he says, use all your senses in the cellar, including listening, putting your ear up to the barrel, and defining what does that pop, 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 pop mean, and when it changes. That is something that you don't get from just reading out of a book. You have to sit in a cellar with a cellar master and be taught that. And I thank Ryan for supporting and bringing Cider Chat up to the area so that I could then deliver this audio to you, because this is not something that I would be able to get via the internet online via Skype. So a big tip of the glass to Ryan and Fieldbird Cider for sponsoring Cider Chat in Ontario, Canada. There are links and show notes to this here episode 132 at ciderchat.com. And make sure that you look at the YouTube video of Ryan demonstrating the use of the baton in the barrel and doing the technique called batonnage, something that I think is really worth doing for creating a different profile to your cider. When I come back, we're going to talk about some of the winners at the Royal Bath and West Cider Competition that took place earlier this June. The Royal Bath and West Cider Competition took place in June, and there were some very interesting winners. First of all, big tip of the glass to the Supreme International winner, a cidery by the name of Johnny Falldown, and it's based in Ireland. So that was pretty cool because they are 2 years in the making as a commercial cidery. Sounds like it's an old estate, family estate, and they did a mix of kind of like scrumping apples, if you will, a nice blend. They also incorporated some of ice wine techniques to bring up the alcohol level. So I'm not sure if they had like the cider. And then they maybe took that cider and froze some of it and kind of like a freeze distillation pulled off. And then they upped the alcohol level. And they also said that also took down the acidity and the tannins. And then they chucked back in some 18th century method champenois fermentation and disgorged it. So this sounds like a delightful cider. Love to get my hands on that. And a big tip of the glass, because getting the Supreme International Champion is no small deal at all. The Reserve International Champion was Willie Smith. That's based in Tasmania, and that was for their Kingston Black. So that was a single varietal, a single variety cider. We also see some American cider makers winning. Of course, we see Angry Orchard, which is always putting into these competitions. Angry Orchard is a very large cidery. We wouldn't expect anything less with the lab methods and the fact they could, you know, fly around the world getting apples from all over the map. But what is more interesting to me is some of these smaller cideries like Johnny Falldown and also the Haken Family Cider. They won for a Dabinet. Now, something to know about Haken Family, they're based in Aurora, Colorado. And Dan Haken, you know, this is a cidery that just opened in 2018. He was winning medals at the amateur competition or the hobbyist competition at Cider Days. And that's when Dan was kind of coming in and trying his wares at it. And then he goes over, you know, sends the cider to the UK and holy smokes, comes in with a silver. That is speaking a lot for your techniques, Dan. And so huge, big tip of the glass to all of you there. And to everyone else that won at this competition, it's kind of fun to see. You know, I'm seeing there was a cider from Poland. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, but they won both a gold and a silver. It's called Cider Chilixi. Their sweet oak won a gold, and then their Lodwy 2016 won a silver. Some Spanish ciders won. Also, another American cidery was Ancho Cider. And Uncle John's Lost Orchard and Uncle John's Apple Pear was entered. One took a silver, one took a bronze. So nice to see that we're seeing a switch of makers sending out, not just into their own back corner, but around the world, especially some of these small cideries that are really, you know, working on a very set budget. So big tip of the glass to all of you, and may the cider keep on going up around the world. We are in the beginning of summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and I hope you are really enjoying this time because there's a lot of summer ahead. And if you are in the winter, well, summer is on its way, and enjoy the cider making while you can. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville. Yeehaw!